In 1966, with three little babies under three, my husband had a job at Harvard Medical School, and I was also a physician, and we lived here for 3 years, and those were the times of great revolt in America. It was the anti-Vietnam War movement. It was the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King was shot when I was here. Bobby Kennedy was shot when I was here. Nixon was elected, which was tragedy because he was clearly clinically paranoid. I didn't get involved politically, but I read voraciously, including the New York Times every day. And those years were really fundamentally, they changed me. I went back to Australia, which is kind of a nice society, but no one does anything. And then my mother had died and I was pretty grief-stricken. And then I read Germaine Greer's book, The Female Eunuch, which really liberated me as a woman. Then I found out that the French had come down to the Pacific Ocean and were blowing up bombs in the atmosphere, and we were getting a high fallout where I lived. So I wrote a letter to the newspaper, which they didn't publish. So I rang them up and said, "Where's my letter?" And he was very haughty and said, "Madam, we get hundreds a day." And I said, "Yeah, but mine's important because children could get leukemia from this radioactive fallout, like Fukushima, you know." And he published the letter, and I was on television that night at this young doctor, not knowing an awful lot, but knowing from my medical studies that radiation caused cancer and deformities. And in 9 months, 75% of Australians rose up and said, "We won't have those bloody French blowing up their bloody bombs," because I found out Australians didn't like the French. They thought they were arrogant. And they stopped buying French perfume, French wine, French cheeses. They wouldn't deliver the French mail. And it was kind of a revolution, and 75% of Australians rose up and said, "This is it." And there were spontaneous marches in the city streets. I went to Paris to see the French Prime Minister, and they said, "Well, our bombs are perfectly safe." So we said, "Well, if they're safe, blow them up in the Mediterranean." And they said, "Mon Dieu, there are too many people living around the Mediterranean." So for the first time in my life, I knew I was sitting opposite wicked politicians who didn't give a damn if Australian children died of leukemia. And that was a very big eye-opener for me. Then a couple of years later, I led the movement against uranium mining in Australia. We've got 40% of the world's richest uranium. And the media were not interested in me this time. The last time, Rupert Murdoch was really promoted what I was doing against the French. He created my career in a way, but this time the media would not touch it. Balance of payments, you know, we all need two swimming pools instead of one type of attitude. So I knew a man who was an engine driver, and he said, "Look, let's talk to all the unions in Australia." So I wrote to them and said, "Can I talk to you about the medical dangers of mining uranium?" And they said, "Yes, but you'll never convince us because we need the jobs." And I got around and I spoke to many, many of the trade unions. There were 86 trade unions in South Australia, for instance. And although they weren't too interested at first, when I started talking about the medical effects of radiation upon their testicles, they became extraordinarily interested. And it was by that method, as a young doctor, that I was able to convince the Australian trade union movement to stop mining or exporting uranium. And they banned uranium mining for 5 years. Then I came to America because both my husband and I were offered jobs at Harvard on the faculty. And I worked in the cystic fibrosis clinic. And I thought, I was so naive. I thought, well, if I've stopped uranium mining in Australia and stopped the French tests, well, I'll close down nuclear power in America. So I got myself on a plane from Boston. I flew down to the AFL-CIO office in Washington, just next to the White House, and it was a great big marble edifice. And I said, "I want to see George Meany, who was the head of the AFL-CIO. I didn't get to see him. I got to see someone else who was the head of the Energy Committee. It turned out he really wasn't interested in me addressing the Energy Committee. He liked taking me out to French restaurants for lunch and dancing with me when he came to Boston. So that didn't work out. I was asked to write an article for the New England Journal of Medicine about the medical effects of nuclear power. And I actually spent a year doing that research, And I also founded the Physicians for Social Responsibility and put an ad in the New England Journal of Medicine about the medical dangers of nuclear power, which came out the day after Three Mile Island melted down. And suddenly we had 500 new members. And we grew exponentially. And in 5 years, we got 23,000 doctors as members, 153 chapters. And we led the movement, actually, against nuclear weapons in the 80s. So profound that movement was that it was really the second American Revolution. Because when I first came here in 78, most Americans said to me they'd rather be dead than red. I said, what do you mean? Oh, we'd rather die in a nuclear war than be communists. And I thought, these people are mad. You know, what are they talking about? So we started having symposia on the medical consequences of nuclear war in Boston, at Harvard, at Stanford, and all over the country, and they became extremely popular. And gradually people learnt that nuclear war was bad for their health. And in 5 years, 80% of Americans became opposed to the concept of nuclear war. And that movement, which involved millions of people, we got 1 million people in Central Park in June 82, the largest march ever in the history of America. That movement led to the end of the Cold War. And it was a sagacious, peaceful Gandhian revolution achieved simply by education. So that's kind of my background in this country. And I founded WAND, Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, because the women really get it, hoping to get 50% of members of Congress by 2010, which we have not achieved.
I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit more about your background in medicine and how. Yeah. It's telling, I think, when you talk about your history and activism here. It is really easy to distance ourselves from conversations about environmental catastrophes, but like you told the story of talking to people about the effects on their testicles or something incredibly personal and immediate about medical effects. I'm wondering if you could talk about your perspective as a doctor in the sort of larger nuclear conversation.
Nuclear power is a deadly energy, and it is carcinogenic. It causes cancer and will for the rest of time with the radioactive waste that lasts for up to 1 million years, and will gradually seep out of the containers in which it is buried, polluting underground water supplies, concentrating in the food. And you can imagine a few generations from now, people waking up in the morning, their babies already being born deformed from plutonium damaging the normal fetus in the uterus, like that drug thalidomide that was used to prevent morning sickness. They were born with no arms or no eyes or the like. Their breast milk will already be radioactive. Their children will be getting cancer and leukemia, you know, under the age of 10 instead of, you know, we get cancer now usually around the age of 50 or 60 because cancer takes a long time to incubate. But babies are extraordinarily sensitive to radiation and radioactive elements that get inside their bodies, like strontium-90 and cesium-137 and plutonium, all of which are made in nuclear power plants. And so it's going to be an absolute catastrophe for our descendants, and that's the heritage we leave them, so we can turn our lights on. And the men who designed the nuclear power plants designed the bombs. And so nuclear bombs and nuclear reactors are one and the same industry. And it's a wicked, wicked industry. It is a carcinogenic industry. It will damage the gene pool, not just of humans, but 30 million other species that cohabit the planet with us. And the weapons industry is unbelievable. They're still making nuclear weapons. Obama's just allocated $180 billion for new nuclear weapons facilities. America's got about 9,000 hydrogen bombs, of which about 2,000 are on hair trigger alert, ready to go with the press of the button. Two men in the missile silos, each with a key, and each with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behavior. The locks to turn the key are 12 feet apart, but if one man ties a string to one key, one man can turn both keys.
Oh, my goodness.
So the deviant one might shoot the normal one and turn the key and launch a nuclear war. Russia has about 2,500 H-bombs targeted on you, and people worry about terrorists. I tell you what, there are 40 H-bombs targeted on New York City as I speak, 60 on Washington. Every town and city in America with a population of 50,000 or more is targeted with at least one bomb. One hydrogen bomb on New York would dig a hole 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep. Let's say it's at the World Trade Tower site, huh? 5 miles from there, everyone will be vaporized, turned into gas, like a little boy in Hiroshima who left his shadow on the pavement. 20 miles from the World Trade Center, everyone will be lethally burnt with third-degree burns. People will be turned into missiles sucked out of the buildings with winds of 500 miles an hour. And they will, of course, be killed as they hit solid objects. Then the whole area will be engulfed in a firestorm of 3,000 square miles. That scenario, and know that every town and city in your country is so targeted, with 40 on New York City, could happen tonight. We get close several times a year to having a nuclear war with Russia, who are now our friends. So why are the weapons still in place? I think it's a case of acute missile envy. The weapons represent penises. And I wrote a book called Missile Envy in the 80s, which was very popular. And the generals in the Pentagon hated it, but they all had a copy on their bookshelves. We need to look deeper, not count the number of bombs, not look at the physical and dreadful damage that would occur from a nuclear war and the end of life, most life on Earth. We need to look at why. And in medicine, if you don't understand the cause of a disease like poliomyelitis, we can't cure it. But Jonas Salk found the poliovirus and he developed the vaccine, and now we've eliminated polio, certainly in the Western world. So what's the cause of the illness of these men who keep wanting hydrogen bombs to virtually blow up the planet? What is their sickness? Is it in their reptilian midbrain? Does their reptilian midbrain have a toxic reaction to testosterone? I ask that question hypothetically, but I think it does. And then I think I want to write a book called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them. But 1 in 25 people are actually psychopaths, sociopaths. And it means that they're brilliant and charming and have relationships with women and stuff, but they have no moral conscience. And they're the ones that rise to the top like cream, like Rumsfeld. And I'm going to dedicate my book to Donald Rumsfeld, like Cheney. And you look at corporations, they're the ones that rise to the top, the sociopaths, very often. Rupert Murdoch's one. And he's a fellow countryman of mine. These are very, very dangerous people. And I think it's time we started making the diagnosis of why the planet is in such jeopardy.
Well, you've kind of segued exactly into one of the questions that I wanted to ask, which I'm 24 years old and consider myself pretty politically conscious and environmentally conscious and the conversation about nuclear power is not at the forefront of the conversations that I'm having with my peers. It isn't, and it hasn't been. And I heard you speak earlier earlier in October about at Liberty Square, at the Occupy Wall Street encampment. And I'd love to hear you talk about the relevance and interconnectedness of nuclear power to conversations that are happening right now about political processes and also about economic injustice.
Well, the whole thing began during the Second World War when it was thought that Hitler was developing nuclear weapons. And so Roosevelt set up the Manhattan Project, which was developed in a little school in New Mexico up in the mazes at Los Alamos. And there was a brilliant physicist called Robert Oppenheimer who led this whole movement to create nuclear weapons. And huge amounts of money were poured into it. And it was really to build the bomb in case Hitler had the bomb. Well, the truth is that by the time the bombs were developed, Hitler was defeated. So what did they do? They saved three cities in Japan. Now, Japan was almost defeated, was negotiating with Russia because Russia were allies with America in the Second World War, for a peace treaty. But what they did was they saved three cities in Japan, and they dropped two atomic bombs on those people who became nuclear guinea pigs. The first bomb was called Little Boy, and they killed 120,000 people, just vaporized them. And a woman was running holding a baby, and she'd been turned into a charcoal statue. I mean, unbelievably wicked nuclear genocide. And not only that, some people survived Hiroshima and ran to the only Christian center in Japan, which was Nagasaki, and they arrived 3 days later to receive the second bomb, which killed 80 to 100,000. And the Japanese will say to you, well, we can kind of understand the first bomb, but why the second? There was no need for those bombs to be used on a human population. They could have said to the emperor, hey, look, we've got something extraordinary. We're going to take you out to an island in the Pacific and show you what it is unless you surrender. Or you can watch it and then you surrender. So that was the first nuclear genocide of wickedness. Then after the war, there was an attempt to internationalize the secret. Bernard Baruch at the UN tried to share the secret with the Russians and everyone. But America said, no, we're the strongest, we're the best, we're going to keep making them. No one else will get the secret. Well, within a few years, the Rosenbergs helped, but the Russians got the secret, and then we're off to a raging start for the nuclear arms race. And the American missiles propped up the Russian missiles, which propped up the American missiles, and they were like two little boys in a sandbox. Mine's bigger than yours. So during the years of the Cold War, America built 77,000 hydrogen bombs. When 1,000 bombs dropping on 100 cities could create nuclear winter and the end of all life on Earth. 77,000 bombs. That is absolute nuclear psychosis. And very few people write about this. And the bomb makers are interesting. There's a very interesting man called Hugh Gustafson, an anthropologist, who went to live with the bomb makers, drank beer with them in the pub at night, spent a year with them. And the bomb makers, before they test the bomb in the desert in Nevada, sleep with the bomb alone in the desert the night before. And they talk about having labor pains. And they talk about the need to push. After the bomb explodes, they talk about postnatal depression. So they are comparing annihilation of the planet with the giving of life. These men are really sick. And that talk was really quite common. Okay, so I don't know why. I mean, now that we're in the nuclear age, when 1,000 bombs on 100 cities could kill all life on Earth by enveloping the Earth with a huge, thick black cloud that blocks out the sun for years and causes an ice age and everyone dies, now we've got to stop fighting. And is it intrinsic in the male brain to fight and kill? That's what I want to explore. But as Einstein said, the splitting of the atom changed everything, all reality, save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. So he really said it. Now, in the 50s, nuclear weapons were getting a fairly bad name. So the weapons makers decided that they would use the energy created in their nuclear reactors, which they created to produce plutonium for their bombs, and use the waste heat to boil water and make electricity. So they started a new program called Atoms for Peace, which Eisenhower launched. And I've got an article coming out on Friday in the International Herald Tribune, and it's going to be online in the New York Times, where I quote a man, a psychologist from the Pentagon, and I can't remember the exact quote, but to paraphrase him, that we need nuclear power is sort of kind of Trojan horse and camouflage for the weapons industry. So that's what it's about. So now we've got 104 reactors, death factories, scattered all over your country, many of them on earthquake faults, like your Indian Point reactors, which are very close to here. If those Indian Point reactors blow and the wind is blowing in your direction, and after Chernobyl, the wind changed 360 degrees in 24 hours and contaminated the whole of Europe, You'll either be dying of acute radiation illness within 2 weeks with your hair falling out, bleeding around your gums, vomiting, diarrhea, and dying of massive hemorrhage or infection like AIDS patients die, because radiation kills the actively dividing cells of your body, which are the hair cells, the gut cells, and the blood cells. Or you will be developing leukemia 5 to 10 years later because the incubation time for cancer is long. It's only 2 days for a cold, but it's long for cancer. Or you'll start developing solid cancers of breast, bowel, lung, thyroid, you name it, 15 years later, and that will go on for the next 70 years. So you are living next to two death machines. The terrorists who flew into the World Trade Towers had in fact targeted the two Indian Point reactors. Had they gone into them, that would have been the end of the financial capital of the world. No one could live there anymore, and millions would now be dying. We're up to 1 million people. They didn't fly into them because they thought they were protected by missiles, but they're not. It's very easy. I could produce a meltdown at Indian Point very easily. In fact, I've written a book called Nuclear Power's Not the Answer, and in that book I describe how, you know, a meltdown could be achieved at Indian Point very easily. So you are living in extreme danger. And it's hard for me to understand how people can live here practicing psychic numbing or not being aware of the danger that threatens you. I don't understand that. Now with Fukushima, which is an absolute total catastrophe, half of Japan is now contaminated. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of cancers are going to be caused by that. Already the New York Academy of Sciences has produced a report on Chernobyl saying that probably 1 million people have died from Chernobyl. 1 million? Well, this accident's worse than Chernobyl. So you multiply it by 2.5 times? And yet there's nothing in the media in America about it. Why are people practicing psychic numbing? What is wrong with this country? And I would say the same for my country in Australia. We don't have nuclear power in Australia. It's too dangerous for us. We just sell uranium for everyone else so they can have nuclear power. Here endeth my soliloquy.
Well, for folks who are just tuning in, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and we're here right now at WGXC's Hudson Studio with Helen Caldicott. Helen is in town because she's speaking tonight at TSL, which is on Columbia Street in Hudson, on the 400 block. She's speaking at 7:30 p.m. There is a suggested donation. What is the name of the talk tonight?
I don't know. What is it?
We don't actually know.
If you love this planet.
If you love this planet. So if you love this planet, it's happening tonight at 7:30. It is true. You just mentioned Fukushima, and that was obviously most recently what brought this conversation into all media, mainstream media. And I've since read about protests in India to prevent the opening of new plants. I've read about Germany's vow to shut down its nuclear plants. Can you give us a sense of what is going on in this country right now in terms of
nothing. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which regulates nuclear power, is funded by the nuclear industry. They've got quite a good chairman called Greg Jasko, but the four others are real... well, I won't say what I think because I'd probably use a rude Australian word. They're not really looking after you at all and making sure those nuclear reactors are safe. Sometimes they do, but on the whole, they're not really. And they're extending the lifespans of reactors. They should be all closed down at the end of 40 years because they're so contaminated, they're so brittle, they're so vulnerable to accidents, and they're extending their lifespans another 20 years. That's an invitation for catastrophe. And they're pumping up the power from 3% enriched uranium to 4.5%, and the things are literally shaking themselves to bits. Why? Because you pay... The taxpayers pay for the uranium enrichment. You pay for the insurance. They can't get insurance if there's an accident. You pay for it. It's called the Price-Anderson Act. You pay for subsidizing the nuclear reactors. Once they're built, Entergy, which runs Indian Point, moves in and sells electricity to you. And they don't give one flying, you know what, whether or not there's an accident or not. All they want to do is pump out as much electricity and sell it. Then... when the reactor is shut down, it has to be decommissioned and taken apart by remote control by robots about 100 years from now. They don't pay for that. You do, except you'll be dead. It'll be your descendants. And the storage of radioactive waste for a million years, that's taxpayers' money too. But I don't know if we'll be around by then. I mean, I mean the human race. When you look at the aspects of global warming and the threat of nuclear war, which could happen tonight and the like, I think, you know, to be quite frank, I think we're doomed unless we all rise up and take back this country. And that's why the Occupy movement is so important. And for the first time for 20 years or so, I felt a sense of joy, anticipation and optimism when I spoke at Wall Street twice.
Okay, I want to get back to that, but first I don't know what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is. I don't know where
who
in government
taught you
it
at
sets.
School? What did you learn at school, Sarah?
I don't know what its charge is. I don't know who sits on it. Can you?
Yeah, there are five people who sit on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I think it's available for six, but there are five at the moment. Most of them, they all come from the nuclear industry. And they're funded by the nuclear industry. I think they were set up by the federal government. I can't tell you exactly how. And they're supposed to oversee all the reactors and make sure they're safe. Well, they cut corners. And because they're funded by the industry, you know, they're on the industry side, not your side, not on the side of the public health of the people. And they know no radiobiology. They know no medicine. They don't tend to understand how cancer is caused by radiation. They don't understand fetuses are thousands of times more sensitive to radiation than adults. You know, one X-ray to the pregnant abdomen doubles the incidence of leukemia in that baby. That's why when you have an X-ray, they say, when was your last menstrual period? Even when you have dental X-rays, which you mustn't ever have unless you've got a sore tooth. And so they don't X-ray you in the second half of your menstrual cycle because you may be pregnant. They don't really understand internal emitters, how they get into the body and how they produce very high doses to a small volume of cells. There should be doctors running this thing. But if there were, the doctors would close down all the reactors tomorrow because that's medically indicated. And I'll tell you, when I do grand rounds at Harvard or at Children's Hospital Medical Center, where I was on the faculty, the best pediatricians, some of them in the country, and I give them a lecture about this, they are absolutely gobsmacked. They can hardly talk because they understand so intrinsically the medical dangers of nuclear power. They're almost weeping. And we spend our lives dedicated to saving the lives of our children and our sick children. So this is just beyond belief, this medical catastrophe that we're living amongst.
Just before going on the air, we were talking about a radio program that you host. It's called If You Love This Planet, also. I'd really like, especially because here we are currently involved in a conversation here about our local media infrastructure and how to create these kinds of conversations where we are here. And I'd like to hear you talk about the role of media and communication in your work.
Well, the media is determining the fate of the Earth without a skerrick of doubt. And it was your wonderful President Jefferson who said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. This democracy is almost totally uninformed, except for little pockets of people who are autodidacts and have educated themselves. Here you are, a very intelligent person, 24. You don't even know, you weren't taught about the medical effects of nuclear power as you grew up or about the nuclear arms race or nuclear weapons. How dare your teachers not make that a mandatory subject? How dare they? So your educational system leaves much to be desired. But the media, and let me tell you, during the 80s, I had a friend who was an agent, Hollywood agent, who had Lily Tomlin and Sally Field and Kenny Bergen and a whole lot of film stars. And she would say to Donahue or whatever, 60 Minutes, look, I'll give you Sally Field and Lily if you'll take Helen Caldicott. Well, no one wanted a boring old woman doctor talking in a tweed suit talking about nuclear war, but they wanted the film stars. So in that way, Pat Kingsley, her name was, got me on all the shows and Good Morning America and This Date and everything and in Vogue and Time and Life and Ladies home journal and family circle, the whole thing. And I would go to the aeroplane counter to get my ticket to fly to some city, and the guy at the counter would say, I saw you last night, you're right. You're right about this, about nuclear war. If everybody, like the women loading coke into their supermarket trolleys, their six kids trailing behind, don't understand the dangers, we are nowhere and we are doomed. And I can't tell you how ferociously I feel about my fellow countryman Rupert Murdoch. He has set up the most ghastly, revolting Fox thing with lies pouring out of those people's mouths. And Roger Ailes, who must be a sociopath, runs the thing. And he can sue me if he wants for saying that, although he's a public figure and he can't sue me. But people need to start speaking the truth about what's happened to the media in your country. And because Fox is so popular, other companies emulate Fox. MSNBC isn't bad, it's got Rachel Maddow and the like. But the average Joe Sixpack watches Fox and is fed by lies. I happen to think that Rush Limbaugh should not be on the air. The Earth is in the intensive care unit, it's terminally ill, and we have an acute clinical emergency on our hands, and it's totally inappropriate for anybody to be on air lying about the scientific data. And I don't believe in freedom of speech when it comes to salvation of the planet. Let me say, if I lied in medicine, I would be deregistered because I would be damaging my patients. It's medically, scientifically, ecologically inappropriate to allow these people who have no knowledge, no scientific background, they're scientifically illiterate, to be on the air. And I will stand by that because we are in a very acute situation. Look, I just heard the head of the International Energy Agency in Turkey, where I recently spoke to Turkish engineers, say that if we continue the way we're going, producing CO2, burning natural gas, burning coal, burning oil, by the end of the century, it's going to be 6 degrees centigrade hotter. That is antithetical to life. If you get to that age, you probably won't, but if you get to that time, you won't survive. Nobody will. And what's the Congress doing? And what's Obama doing? He came in with such promise. You know, why hasn't he got a spine like FDR to stand, or like Johnson? LBJ was pretty tough, to stand up to these stupid characters. And they're stupid. Why don't they call them stupid when silly little Backman says what she says without a skerrick of evidence or knowledge? I don't understand what's going on in this country. You know, we once had great statespeople. Look at Teddy Kennedy. You know, I knew Teddy. He was a close friend of mine, the lion of the Senate. And he could get on with people from both sides of the Senate. He was admired and respected and magnificent man. I once said to Teddy, you've done more for this country than both your brothers combined. And he thanked me. Well, of course, he had more time. He lived longer. But I'm sorry I'm raving, but I can't help but feel passionate, having spent the majority of my life trying to save the planet. And, you know, here we are. I'm 73. I could be dead tomorrow, you know. And now here you are, this lovely 24-year-old beautiful girl sitting here. Makes me feel like weeping.
Well, I like when you started a sentence earlier with, like, to be frank. And I thought you had been pretty frank for the 20 minutes prior.
Well, I'm an Australian, so Aussies just shoot from the hip.
Well, so one of the other things that we don't see or hear in the media is the work of anti-nuclear activists. Could you also talk a little bit about
what... I should be on the media all the time. You know, I couldn't even get on NPR here. What's the matter with NPR, National Petroleum Radio, or Nuclear Petroleum Radio? Because they take ads from the nuclear industry. God damn them. What are they doing that for? You know, it used to be really good when I was here in the 60s, NPR. It was terrific. Once they take ads, they compromise. So what was your question?
My question is if you could also paint a picture for us of the landscape of anti-nuclear activism going on right now.
Well, the truth is that there are very few really good organizations in Washington who really carry the whole load and do brilliant things and take on the nuclear companies who want to build nuclear reactors, and they sue them, and, you know, they use lawyers and stuff, and they write wonderful articles. But it's quite a small movement. Now, if I could get on television, or other people could, or I could even argue with... do you know what I'd love to do? Get on with Rush Limbaugh and really sock it to him. Or that awful... you know, who are the other ones? I don't know. Anyway, it's time there was an open debate, and that people like me and others could speak the truth. It's imperative. You know, I often think if there was one case of rabies in New York City, New York would go burko. New York Post, you know, that'd be all over the front page. And yet here we are sitting with a potential catastrophe that's almost beyond compare with the Indian Point reactors, built near an earthquake fault.
Can you actually talk more about the Indian Point reactor? It is our closest reactor here.
Yeah.
Could you tell us
is
more about
it? Is your electricity a carcinogenic electricity? Do you know? Where does your electricity come from? You've got some lights on here. Your studio is run by electricity. Where does your electricity come from?
I don't know.
Well, you need to know. In fact, every single person must know where their electricity is generated. Americans waste 28% of the electricity they currently use. Nuclear power only generates 20%, so you close all your reactors down, Bob's your uncle, you could survive very well. You've got to stop using those stupid clothes dryers that are made by General Electric, which makes good things for life, like clothes dryers, dishwashers, nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons, you know? So don't use clothes dryers. Hang your clothes outside in the sun in the summer, and in the winter hang them up by the furnace and they'll dry in a flash. Don't use dishwashers. You know, put a bit of water in your kitchen sink, just a bit of nice hot water with a little bit of detergent, and wash your dishes by hand. Don't leave all your computers on at night and your radios and your DVDs and all these lights flashing. Turn them all off. There are so many things you can do. Why does the federal government spend $1 trillion on killing? The Pentagon. Why is it socialism for killing and capitalism for you, and you don't even have a free healthcare system in the richest country on earth? We have a free healthcare system in Australia. We don't pay anything. Best medical care in the world. Why don't you have that? Why isn't the money deviated from the Pentagon $1 trillion from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, GE and all the folks that make the weapons and stuff to putting solar panels on every single house in America? Solar hot water systems. How many millions of people would that employ? And we need jobs. What would happen to the GDP? It would go through the ceiling. Why aren't there windmills everywhere across America? Why aren't you making windmills? In the Rust Belt, where the auto companies have closed down, they could be producing windmills and absolutely pumping them out. You could become totally self-sufficient with renewable energy by 2040. With no nuclear and no carbon production, and I would refer you to a study called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, published on IEER.org. It's a brilliant study by Dr. Arjun Makajani to show that you can be carbon free, nuclear free, and help to save the planet by 2040.
Okay, can we talk a little bit specifically about Indian Point? About
yes.
It helps me at least to sort of bring it down to.
Okay. Well, there are three reactors there. One is closed. Two are open. They're 1,200 megawatt reactors. They're big ones. A megawatt is 1,000,000 watts of electricity, so they're both 1,200 megawatts. They've been operating for about 40 years. They have a huge amount of radioactive waste sitting there in what are called spent fuel pools, which must be continually cooled. And if they're not, they could melt down, like happened at Fukushima. There's probably up to 20 to 30 times more radiation in the spent fuel pools than there is in each of the reactors. In each reactor is as much radiation as that produced by 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. When you put the uranium in the reactor and fission it, as in E equals MC squared. You understand that, don't you? Because you're well educated. The uranium becomes 1 billion times more radioactive. And 200 new radioactive elements are made, some which last seconds and some which last billions of years. And let's take one of them. One of them is called plutonium. Who is Pluto?
Who is Pluto?
Yeah.
The philosopher?
No, I wasn't a philosopher.
Who is
the
Pluto?
The dog?
Pluto the dog?
No, I'm teasing you. Pluto was the god of hell.
Oh, Pluto the god.
Pluto the god, and plutonium is named after the Pluto, the god of hell, god of underworld. Plutonium is man-made, and it's made when a uranium-238 atom captures a neutron, and it converts to plutonium-239, which is why they made reactors in the first place to make their bombs, because you need 10 pounds of plutonium to make yourself an atomic bomb. You need to know the design is on the internet. If you steal a lump of plutonium, you make yourself an atomic bomb. But that hasn't happened. Each reactor makes 500 pounds of plutonium a year. So each country that buys a reactor from you and General Electric has a capacity to make many bombs every year. And that causes lateral proliferation of nuclear weapons, okay? And enhances the prospect of nuclear war, number one. Number two, plutonium lasts for 500,000 years. It's got a half-life of 24,400 years. Do you know what a half-life is? What? Did you not learn physics at school? What did you learn at school? Did you learn physics?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's a half-life?
I don't know if I could define it.
Did you learn that at school?
Yeah, I'm sure that I
did. Every American should know what a half-life is. If you have a pound of plutonium in 24,400 years, it decays, so you have half a pound of active plutonium. In 24,400 years, you have a quarter of a pound. And you multiply a half-life by 20 to get its total life, radiological life. So plutonium lasts for a quarter to 500,000 years, right? 1/1,000,000th of a gram, if inhaled, will give you cancer. Well, it may be less. It may be 10 to the minus 9 grams, 1 picogram. Will give you cancer. A tiny, tiny, tiny speck. The body thinks plutonium is iron, so it handles it like iron and stores it in the liver where it causes liver cancer. In the bone where the hemoglobin is made, needing iron, so it causes bone cancer or leukemia. It is stored in the, it goes to the testicle. Every male has a tiny amount of plutonium in his testicle from fallout from the weapons testing days. The incidence of testicular cancer is rising. And what is more important is that in the testicles of the sperm, the genes for all future generations, and what plutonium does is mutate the genes in the sperm so that a baby could be born deformed with a genetic disease or pass the genetic abnormality on generation to generation, like for diabetes or cystic fibrosis. Or phenol, I mean, there are 2,600 such diseases. So we're increasing the incidence of genetic abnormalities by loading up the environment with plutonium. Plutonium also crosses the placenta, which lets nothing pass, and gets into the developing embryo, which may be genetically chromosomally normal, but the plutonium could kill a cell that's going to form the left half of the brain or the septum of the heart or the right arm, and that's called teratogenesis, damage of a normal embryo, which is born deformed. And we're seeing those abnormalities now in Fallujah and Basra, where America's conducting a nuclear war in Iraq using uranium-238 weapons, which have a similar impact to plutonium. So that's only one of the 200 isotopes made. One is plutonium-241, which is even more dangerous than plutonium-239. In your smoke detectors, they are all powered by plutonium-241. No, americium-241, sorry. Americium-241, which is more dangerous than plutonium-239. And I testified at the New York State Fire Department in 1976, begging them not to use americium in the smoke detectors, but to use photovoltaic cells. And they went ahead and used americium. So that means if the fire burns the house down, out goes americium and someone can inhale it. There's an awful lot to learn.
Well, and it seems like so much of the conversation about reactors or about plants, especially in the wake of what happened in Fukushima, has to do with safety, the safety of these spaces as opposed to their existence.
What do you mean
safety?
Well,
that's
mean?
My question. My next question is...
What do you mean? They are as safe as the fallibility of the people that build them. And man is the weak link in the nuclear chain. And man will always make mistakes. You know what happened in Chernobyl? There was a stupid man late at night, who was an expert in hydropower, not even nuclear, who conducted a really crazy experiment. And the thing suddenly blew up. And he said to his two underlings, go out, because he was in the control room, which filled up with a white powder, go and see what's happened. And they went out and came back and said, it's gone. And he said, what? What's gone? They said, the reactor's gone. He said, don't be ridiculous. Go and look again. It had gone. It contaminated 40% of Europe, and for the next 600 to thousands of years, 40% of Europe will be radioactive. I do not eat European food because I don't know what food is radioactive in Europe and what is not. I look very carefully to see. Now, if Indian Point melted down, I've written about a meltdown at Indian Point in my book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer. Can you imagine? The sirens would sound. The radio would be blasting out warnings. People would get in their cars and rush to the kindergartens and schools to get their children. There would be total gridlock on the way. The radio would be blaring out what's happening. You would dare not breathe because you knew you would be breathing in radioactive stuff. If you got out of your car, the radioactive stuff landing on the ground would produce what's called ground shine. Really high levels of radiation like X-rays, gamma rays, coming off from the ground, from the radioactive elements landing on it. And imagine what would happen in Manhattan. All the tunnels would be blocked. All the bridges would be blocked. There'd be gridlock and people would be sitting ducks, 10 million, 9 million, to be irradiated and to get maybe weeks later acute radiation illness. Can you imagine the panic, the anxiety, the terror? And that could happen tonight. And it would happen here because the wind would change and blow the stuff over you. I mean, I feel like weeping as I talk about it. And, you know, when you come into our hospitals and you're all radioactive, we don't know what to do with you. The government says, FEMA, take you down to the basement and hose you down to the mortuary to get the radiation off your skin. But we can't get it out of your lung, or your gut, or your liver, and you are then destined probably to die of cancer. And children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. So what are we doing?
Well, just a few minutes ago you were talking about feeling optimistic. I heard you say that word. you said it specifically in reference to the Occupy stuff Wall Street, going on, and you also, that your talk tonight is called If You Love This Planet,
right.
Which is...
Well, do you know what? We can fix all of this. Now, I wouldn't be out here doing all this crazy work, really boring, giving the same lecture for 40 years. I'd be practicing medicine. Well, I am practicing global preventive medicine if I didn't think there were solutions. So the solutions are, one, Occupy movement closed down every single reactor in America within a year. Two, Occupy movement takes over your Congress because you are the leaders and your congresspeople are your representatives. Three, all of you know who your congresspeople and senators are and you go and see them once a week and educate the silly people so they represent you, because the vacuum you leave gets filled by the corporations. Three, you will work with Russia to abolish nuclear weapons, and that's pretty easy, and now even Henry Kissinger, who's a war criminal, is talking about that. So you abolish nuclear weapons between Russia and America, who own 97% of the 23,000 H-bombs in the world. 97% of the weapons in the world are owned by Russia and America. And three, you will stop burning coal now, or you are doomed. And you will cover all your parking lots with solar panels. You will import electric cars from China, and you will drive your cars with solar energy and then plug them into your house at night and charge up your house at night, also with your solar panels. And number four, you will fill up your country with windmills and with solar panels, and you will stop spending $1 trillion on death with the Pentagon. I mean, it's pretty easy. I know you might sound overwhelmed, but, you know, I actually led a revolution in your country and I was an alien and a woman, you know. I've just got a note passed to me. Cuomo's been opposed to relicensing Indian Point. everyone should write to Cuomo, go and see him and support him to get Indian Point closed down. That's good. You've got a governor on side. That's very, very important. Use your democracy. You know, in Australia, voting's compulsory. If we don't vote, we get fined. No one should dare to live in this country without voting. If they don't vote, they have no right to live in America. They should go and live in Yemen or the Sudan. Huh? Because you don't have a democracy if you don't use it. You create a vacuum. And I can't tell you how annoyed I feel with people who are so lazy they don't even vote. And then once you vote, then your Occupy movement, as I said, you have to know who your congresspeople are and you have to make sure they represent you and your future and not those blasted corporations who pour money into their pockets. Money is the root of all evil, huh? What did Shakespeare say? He had a lovely quote about money. I can't think about it now. But money's become the new god here. When I come from Australia, I'm always overwhelmed at how people are shouting at me to spend money and save this and save that by spending money. The real happiness and key to happiness in life is serving others, is being all day in my clinic looking after my patients, or giving a really good lecture to 1,000 people and changing their lives that night, or helping to lead a revolution to save the planet. That's the only thing that makes you happy, or working with others in your Occupy movement. You've got the seeds of a real revolution here.
Well, we've just got a couple more minutes, unfortunately, here. I feel like there's... I had wanted to ask you a little bit more detailed about kind of imagining a future of alternate sources of energy.
Well, I've told you about it. Download that book, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, IEER.org, and you've got it. And read it. It's a bit complex, but when I was reading it, I was sitting in my bath and I felt like Archimedes. You know, when he discovered the Archimedes principle, he ran down the street naked. He was so excited. I felt like that.
Are there other resources you want to recommend to people who are listening who want to...
Yes, I've got a webpage called nuclearfreeplanet.org that's full of information about Indian Point and Fukushima and Chernobyl and the whole thing. Also, I suggest you go to the New York Academy of Sciences webpage and download or order their book on Chernobyl that was published last year. That's an imperative read. Yes, and I would like you to start playing If You Love This Planet here. I mean, I've interviewed wonderful people like Daniel Ellsberg and Nader and Martin Sheehan and Lily Tomlin. I mean, fantastic people and some of the real leaders of science in the world. And I would really strongly recommend that you play If You Love This Planet on this station. I would be thrilled. Yeah, well, I've just got a note here to say that 2 out of 3 Americans will probably develop cancer in their lifetime, and part of that is because we live in a chemical cocktail of 80,000 chemicals in common use, including those plastic bottles you drink your stupid water out of. Never drink water out of a plastic bottle. It's got carcinogens in it, BPAs. But also... America blew up over 1,000 bombs in the atmosphere, and you got a hell of a fallout in upstate New York during the 50s and 60s. And the incidence of cancer is really high here, including thyroid cancer. And I want to write an article, actually, about that for a major publication. So the fallout is causing cancer. And then, of course, we're talking about nuclear power over time inducing huge, huge epidemics of cancer. So nuclear power is a carcinogenic industry and must be closed down. And it's a weapons industry, so it must be closed down. It's very simple. 1 and 1 = 2. No, but all it requires is using your incredible passion and energy to save the planet. Don't tell me you haven't got it. I had it. I've been doing it for 40 years. If I can do it and I'm an alien, you're not even an alien. You were born here. You could get to be president. Right?
Yeah. Well, Helen, I have to thank you so much, not only for your work as a practicing global preventative physician, but also for coming into WJXC studio
today. Oh,
that's been
my joy today. It's a lovely studio. I really wish you luck.
And if folks who are listening want to continue the conversation, Helen is going to be at TSL tonight. It's on 434 Columbia Street in Hudson. She's speaking at 7:30. There will be a question and answer session too.
And my books will be for sale, and I will sign them afterwards. So if you want to grab a book, come. If you want to be frightened but face reality and then have a lot of joy in your life by helping to save the planet, come tonight. It's a very joyful experience.
Well, Helen, thank you so much. We will see you tonight.
Thank you.
WGXC helps you sleep at night and stay awake in the daytime. Whether at work or play, in good times and in bad, no matter the weather, community radio brings you local news, agricultural information, music and sounds, oratory, and radio stews.
90.7 FM, WGXC.
The 90.7 FM
Ica.
Copic.
Carol.
Catskill. Greenport. Claverack. Kinderhook.
Maryville.
Germantown.
Windham. Greenville.
Schoharie. Green County.
Patrick. Ashland.
Chatham.
And East Durham.
Baffins.
Haines Falls. Hunter.
And, Coxsackie.
Preston Hollow. Oak Hill.
Ankrum. Great Barrington.
Hawthorne Valley.
New Baltimore.
Hudson, New York.
Hi, this is Chad Weckler, one of WGXC's underwriting coordinators. Every day, local businesses support WGXC by underwriting the station. These underwriters are people like you, local, diverse, and supportive of hands-on media. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and mentioning that you heard them on WGXC. If your business would like to reach out to WGXC's listeners, you can learn how at wgxc.org/underwriting. Or just call us at 518-828-0290. WGXC Underwriting, your customers are listening.
WGXC Underwriting support is provided by Homespun Occasions, Old Time Square and Contra Dancing with caller and live fiddle music for special events, community celebrations, and school programs. www.homespun.biz or 1-800-908-HOME.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC. like good old tap water. Just turn it on and get it.
Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and today we're talking to a sort of close to Catskillian author. I suppose you are a Catskillian author in New Pulse, Greg Oliar, whose somewhat suggestive title of his latest novel is Father Mucker. And try to say that when you've had a few drinks without meeting FCC objections on air. So, Greg, I mean, this is fascinating novel. I must confess, it resonated with me since I am a late parent with two young children, both obsessive, 3 and 8, and I spend a lot of time chasing around after them while trying to run a career. And up in the Catskills in Livingston Manor, you are in New Pulse, and I never realized that New Pulse was such a seething mass of interest, affairs, and sexual prestidigitation. Please explain, is this autobiographical? Is this true? Is this reportage or is it fiction?
No, it's definitely a work of fiction. I mean, I get that question. First of all, I want to thank you for having me on the show. It's a great, great pleasure to be here. Virtually to be here, because we're of course not in the same physical space. But to get back to your question, I mean, I portray New Pulse as being kind of a hotbed of infidelity, I suppose you can say, with a lot of stuff going on.
Polyamory, I think it is, because half the people there are all declared infidel. If you declare that you're being unfaithful in some ways, you're not being unfaithful in the modern parlance, are you?
I guess not. I don't know. Okay. So people do ask, you know, I get that question, is it really like this? And I think that, you know, yes and no. I think that stuff happens here. The things that happen in the book are fiction. Are things that I made up, but I think that things happen everywhere. I don't think that it's confined to New Pulse by any means. I think no matter where you go, no matter how conservative a place you go, even stuff is happening. Anytime you have